Was wir wissen. Ein Podcast des österreichischen Wissenschaftsfonds FWF.
Hallo und willkommen bei Was wir wissen. Mein Name ist Thomas Zauner und heute habe ich euch etwas Besonderes mitgebracht. Bevor wir nächste Woche mit unserer zweiten Staffel zum Thema Zufall starten, gibt es heute ein Interview mit Mark Thompson. Er ist Chef des Kernforschungszentrums CERN. Am CERN steht der berühmte Teilchenbeschleuniger LHC, mit dem das Higgs-Teilchen gefunden wurde. Dafür gab es sogar einen Nobelpreis. Ich spreche mit Thompson über die aktuelle Forschung am CERN, darüber, was dort als nächstes geplant ist, wie unsere Gesellschaft von der Grundlagenforschung dort profitiert und welche Rolle CERN bei Europas technologischer Souveränität spielt. Da er Brite ist, machen wir das auf Englisch. Mark Thompson ist auf Einladung des österreichischen Wissenschaftsfonds FWF bei den Technology Talks 2026 in Wien zu Gast. Diese Veranstaltung des Austrian Institute of Technology findet vom 10. bis 11. September im Museumsquartier in Wien statt. Mehr Infos dazu und Tickets gibt es unter technologytalks.ait.ac.at. Den Link dazu stelle ich auch in die Shownotes. Jetzt geht's los mit dem Interview mit Mark Thompson. Director General, Mark, thank you for taking the time. I will start right into it. The particle accelerators and the antimatter factory at CERN have recently entered the long shutdown 3. They will be upgraded to explore new physics in the coming years. In this phase, what are CERN's biggest challenges, both in research and beyond?
Thanks, Thomas. Yes, so it's a good question. So just put it in context, we fairly regularly go in, we have long shutdowns, basically to maintain the infrastructure we have, which is very, very complex. This long shutdown is a particularly long one, even longer than normal. This is 4 years long. So it's a really interesting period. So what we're doing is we're replacing about 1.2 kilometers of the sections of the Large Hadron Collider with a technology that just didn't exist when the Large Hadron Collider was built and designed. So it's a very advanced superconducting technology. And the reason we're doing that is it's going to make the machine roughly 10 times brighter. So that's a major, major increase in capability. Now, at the same time, we have these giant detectors that photograph, you know, the images, they take the images of the particle physics interactions we see. These are giant detectors. Those are being upgraded as well. So the whole plan here is at the end of this 4 years, we will have a machine that's 10 times brighter. We'll have detectors that have a technology that just, again, didn't exist, when the detectors were being built. So it's like upgrading your iPhone from iPhone 4 to iPhone 17. So all of this adds up to a much more capable machine. So much more data. So we're about 10%. We've analyzed probably about 10% of the data that we'll ultimately have, and better detectors. So this is a huge increase in capability. So it's very, very exciting. We know we're going to make some really interesting measurements. And of course, there's always an opportunity of discovery because you've got this giant leaping capability. You asked me what the challenges are. The upgrade of the machine, replacing these magnets, they're the most complex bit, by the way, of the machine, and the upgrade of the detectors. These are the biggest things that CERN has done and the experimental collaborations have done for 20 years. And this is all going on in parallel. So the challenges are technical, really big projects, managing those projects and doing everything in parallel. So the challenge is technology, but also logistics. A lot of stuff we need to get down underground. So it's a very exciting time. And at CERN, we're really committed to keeping our schedule to what it is now. So we want to switch the machine back on in 2030. That's the plan. And that's, you know, we're committed to meeting that goal.
Speaking of discoveries, is there anything specific you hope for?
I'll often answer that question. I mean, the thing about discoveries, if you discover something, you by its nature, you don't know what you're going to discover. So we know we have this giant leap in capability. So that gives us an opportunity. Anything I would hope for, there's this theory out there called supersymmetry. It's a very elegant theoretical concept. Now, we haven't seen any evidence of that in our current data, but there are still pockets places where supersymmetry could be hidden. And that's where you never know by having this additional capability. So, for example, what would I like the most? Direct detection of dark matter in an accelerator, you know, production and detection of dark matter or candidates for dark matter. It's not completely out of the questions, but that would be incredibly exciting. But to be honest, I mean, we're just pushing the capability of what we have. Who knows what we're going to see? We may just see something completely unexpected.
You just mentioned supersymmetry. Do I remember correctly that this is the idea that each particle has an associated symmetric particle, right?
That's right. So supersymmetry is a theory that solves some of the theoretical issues of our current standard model. And it turns out that in our understanding of theory, it's very difficult to add new stuff to the standard model without breaking the whole structure of the theory.
Hallo, ich schalte mich hier kurz aus der Postproduktion dieser Folge dazu für alle, die nicht ganz so tief in der Teilchenphysik drin sind. Das Standard Model, also Standardmodell der Teilchenphysik, von dem Mark Thompson hier spricht, beschreibt die kleinsten Bausteine unserer Welt und wie diese zusammenspielen. Da geht es um die eher noch bekannten Protonen und Neutronen und Elektronen, die zusammen Atome formen, aber auch um exotischere Teilchen wie Myonen und W- und Z-Bosonen. Da gibt es einen ganzen Haufen davon. Jetzt wieder zurück zu Mark Thompson.
Now you can do this with supersymmetry. So much of what we base our detailed theory on, it comes from symmetry principles. And it turns out there aren't many symmetry principles that kind of actually make any mathematical sense. Supersymmetry does. And it would mean that for every particle we have, so let's take an electron, you have a supersymmetric particle for the electron. The sector where I think this is particularly interesting is what we call the electroweak sector. So it's the Higgs boson, the W and Z bosons, the kind of very massive particles. They could have supersymmetric partners as well. And that would be very interesting. And it's possible that supersymmetric partner could be a candidate for dark matter. But we haven't seen it yet, we'll see.
Now, looking a bit farther into the future, ideas about a new particle accelerator, much bigger than the current Large Hadron Collider, are currently being discussed. It is called the Future Circular Collider, FCC, and it is planned to be 91 kilometers long. What is the current status of this project?
Yeah, so we discovered at CERN, in 2012, the Higgs boson. It's very difficult to understate the importance of that discovery. It's one of the biggest discoveries in fundamental science for the last 50 years, certainly, no question about it. And it's completely different from anything else we've ever seen. And it has very strange properties. And its properties determine much of what we see in the universe today. It determines the masses of all of the particles, for example. So if you change the property of the Higgs boson or the coupling of the Higgs boson to the electron mass would change. Size of your atoms would change. It determines the stability of matter in some sense as well. So it's really, really important. And it's completely different type of matter. So what we want to do is build a Higgs factory, make lots of Higgs bosons, and measure them incredibly precisely to really understand the properties, to see if it really behaves exactly as we expect it to. And potentially, we can then use the Higgs boson as a window into the stuff we don't understand. So the idea of building an electron-positron Higgs factory has been out there for quite a number of years now. And that's what the FCC electron-positron collider would be. It's basically a precision instrument to dissect the Higgs boson and really understand exactly what it is. And that's the scientific motivation. It's 91 kilometers, very bright in terms of a particle collider. So we want to make, it's a factory, we want to make many Higgs bosons and measure their properties very precisely. So this year in May, CERN Council updated the European strategy for particle physics. And there's a scientific consensus that this machine is the right thing for CERN after the high luminosity LHC, which is what we're building at the moment. Now, it's not approved yet. So we're doing the final stages of some of the planning. And then the intention is then to go back to CERN Council in 2028. To start the approval process. So that's where we are. We have a very clear model of what we want to do. We know why we want to do it. And I would just say there's a clear scientific consensus within the particle physics community that this is the right thing to do. And in June, at CERN Council, we've approved our strategy for progressing the machine, and we'll take that forward. And, you know, one of my jobs is to make sure that the project plans are there, we're ready to do it, and to seek the resources that we need to do it. And that's going to be both from our existing member states, but also looking for contributions outside our existing member states. A visionary project, 91-kilometer collider, there's only going to be one of them in the world. And the way I see it, it's not just particle physics. This is just an inspirational vision for science, not just for particle physics. And doing that in Europe, I think, is really important. I think one of the things comes in the context of the high luminosity LHC and FCC as well, actually, is we've made huge progress in particle physics over the last few decades. I mean, huge progress, where we have a really good description of the universe from almost from the Big Bang to what we see today, which is absolutely remarkable. That's not just particle physics, that's cosmology as well, of course. But we also know in that picture, there's so many things we don't really understand why it's the way it is. We can describe it, and we know, but we know there are big gaps in our knowledge. And yeah, one of the big gaps is why there is matter left in the universe at all. Why didn't it all annihilate? The universe creates matter and antimatter in equal parts. Should all have gone? That didn't happen. We know it didn't happen because we see the universe today. But we don't know why. We don't have an explanation of that yet. So that's just an example of something where there's a big question out there. And we know what the big question is, but we don't know the answer. And another example is we know we've only seen 5% of the universe, the luminous matter. We know there's dark matter out there. And there's something called dark energy, which we don't understand. So we know it's there, but we don't know what it is. And that's a huge question. We don't really know why the Higgs boson is quite like it is, and there are many questions related to the Higgs boson. So we have this long list of really, really big questions. Why I'm so optimistic about the future of particle physics and cosmology, actually, is we're doing all the right experiments to give us a chance of getting answers for these big questions. And if we tick one of these big questions off, this is huge. I mean, this is not just a small discovery. These are any answering any one of these big questions would be a major discovery. So you know, I think it was earlier this week. I mean, the first possible hints for a direct observation of dark matter, just one event, could just be statistical fluctuation chance. We'll see. Give it time. That would be incredibly exciting. So there's a lot of excitement out there. And the main thing is we're doing the right experiments, and high luminosity LHC is one of those projects that's going to push the boundaries. FCC will push the boundaries even further. So I'm very optimistic about the future.
And this all takes decades to implement, I guess. Do you have a rough roadmap for that?
Yeah. No, there's a very precise roadmap, actually. We know we have very good, very solid plans. So we will run the high luminosity LHC until 2041. And the plan is to then to start commissioning of the FCC EE sometime between 2045 and 2048. So we don't want a very large gap between the end of the high luminosity LHC and the start of the future circular collider. But also we have to have a plan that's financially viable. And the exact details of that plan, a lot of the exact timings will depend on the financing the project. But that's our target. It's the second half of the 2040s. So quite a long way off, but not in the infinite future.
Now, moving away from research to the topic of technology. The initial development of the World Wide Web is one of the biggest examples of now common technology stemming from CERN. Are there other current examples of common technologies initially developed at CERN?
This is always a difficult question, because what we do at CERN is we develop technologies, World Wide Web being a technology, to meet our scientific mission. Now, the World Wide Web is a bit of a special one to share data between different infrastructures and different areas. But when we're building something like the Large Hadron Collider, we don't, you know, originally when you conceive of the project, you don't have the technology to do it. So you then develop that technology. And what happens then is that technology gives you a new capability, a new technological capability to do other stuff. And sometimes that finds a place in everybody's life very quickly. Sometimes it will take a decade or two. So I think the examples of technologies that have transferred rather rapidly, some of our accelerator technologies that we've developed over the last 20 years, are now the basis of very advanced cancer treatment, including in Austria. Hadron therapy is a very, very advanced treatment for particularly difficult difficult cancers. All of that technology came out of actually pushing accelerator technology very, very hard. That's not why we did it at CERN. We did it for the science, but then we transferred that knowledge to kind of medical applications of that particular science. So there are numerous aspects of technologies we developed at CERN that then find their way into other sectors. Another example I like very much actually is some of the silicon technology that we use in our big detectors. We had to make new silicon sensors that were radiation hard because the LHC is a very hostile environment. Those radiation hard sensors were then subsequently used in the development and advancement of a technique called cryo-electron microscopy. That technique is changing structural biology and our understanding of life. So that's a different type of innovation that's changed, you know, really advanced a different area of science. So there are many examples of this. And at the moment, we're looking at the development of what are known as high temperature superconductors for magnet technology.
Hallo nochmals aus der Postproduktion. Die High Temperature Superconductors, von denen Thompson hier spricht, sind übersetzt Hochtemperatur Supraleiter. Supraleiter sind Materialien, die keinen elektrischen Widerstand haben. Anders als jedes andere Material. Damit geht darin keine Energie verloren, wenn man einen Strom durch sie schickt. Bisher gefundene Supraleitermaterialien funktionieren aber nur bei extrem niedrigen Temperaturen. Hochtemperatur-Supraleiter sollen dann bei nur so minus 70 Grad Celsius statt minus 270 Grad Celsius funktionieren. Die zu entwickeln, wäre wirklich eine technologische Revolution. Jetzt zurück zu Thompson.
This is really right at the forefront of, we don't really have that capability at the moment. If we have that, it means we can make more environmentally sustainable accelerators because they'll use a lot less energy. But by pushing that technology in a different direction, it potentially could have all sorts of other applications. But you don't know when you're doing it. We're doing it for the science. And that's the big difference of what we do at CERN. Everything we do starts from our scientific goals. And then when we have something new, we then try and transfer that to industry and other applications.
You mentioned the cancer treatment facility in Austria. Is this MedAustron in Wiener Neustadt?
Yes, it is. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That comes directly out of a program at CERN to transfer the technology we had at CERN into medical applications.
Widening our scope even more, what do you think is CERN's broader role in Europe and the world beyond research? And how does it impact Europe's technological sovereignty?
I mean, actually, it's a great question. I'll start with the first one, which is the more political, diplomatic side, if you put it like that. So when CERN was created back in 1954, one of the aims under the banner of Science for Peace was to bring European countries back together in the post-war period around a scientific goal that everybody could get behind. And part of that was to really kind of bring back science to Europe in, you know, a very difficult environment. So CERN was founded on the principle of bringing countries together behind science for peace, a very simple mission, which is to discover, understand the nature of the universe. So that part of what we do at CERN is still there. And I think in the current slightly fractured geopolitical situation that we find ourselves in, I think the role of places like CERN, when we have a very pure scientific mission, where countries can come together and work together behind a very, how do I put it, a non-controversial, a goal of discovery, discovering the universe, something that's clearly good for humanity. That, I think, is very, very important. I think it's really important today that we provide at CERN a place where countries do come together behind this mission of discovery. And we see that. We see the enthusiasm, certainly from our member states. It's a forum where they can work together. So I believe that's really, really very, very important. The second question on European technological sovereignty. So again, if you look at, you know, where is Europe leading? Genuinely leading the globe. Where is Europe ahead of the US, ahead of China? There are very few areas. Particle physics is one. And that's partly because of this collaborative model that CERN has had for 72 years now that's brought countries together. So we are at the forefront of particle physics. So what that means, it goes back to that previous question you asked, actually, around how does technology that we develop at CERN then find its way in other areas? we are constantly pushing at that technology, and we're doing that in Europe. And we're very focused at making sure that the benefits that come out of CERN benefit our member states, or effectively benefit the continent of Europe. So I think CERN can be viewed as a driver of technological sovereignty, part of the picture, how to keep Europe at the really right at the forefront of technology. Now, we can't do everything. We have a very clear mission, but we can play a role in, you know, keeping Europe at the forefront of technology.
And regarding the development of technologies, how do you deal with dual use of technologies?
So it's always a topic. I mean, CERN in CERN's convention actually has a very clear statement that nothing we will do will be used for military applications. Having that written in our convention, I think, is very, very helpful, very clear. The nature of what we do, you know, it is for discovery science. So we're not developing technologies that naturally transfer to dual use applications. But of course, everything you can do can be used for good or can be used in different ways. But our convention is very clear on what CERN does, and we're very aware of the need for CERN as an organization to respect that statement in our convention, that this is effectively science for peace, science for non-military applications. We're aware it's probably just by the nature of what we do, it is quite a long way from dual use applications.
You already spoke about the diplomatic and political role of CERN in Europe and beyond. Has this role changed in the last years, especially considering the rising tensions internationally?
It's a good question. So I think the one issue that was very challenging for CERN's council, this is not CERN management. I mean, CERN is there for science. I think most of our scientists believe that we should be working without boundaries, without borders. The invasion of Ukraine was very difficult, and that led to the non-continuation of the cooperation agreement with Russia. And that was a political decision of CERN Council, and you can understand the reasons why when a country in Europe was in the situation that Ukraine was. So that's a real exception. That's probably the one exception where things have changed drastically. I would like to, you know, emphasize, and in a positive note, our relations with the US are excellent. And we have very strong relations with the US, and it's a bilateral relation where we work with the US to help them. They work with us to help CERN in, for example, our high luminosity LHC project. The US is a big partner. That relationship remains really strong, which I'm really pleased to say that. So we haven't really seen, you know, apart from this, you know, the difficult situation with the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we really haven't seen significant impacts of the geopolitical situation. And again, I think the US is actually a really excellent example of that. The relations are very, very good.
Does China play a role in all of this, or are they more seen as a separate player?
They're somewhat a separate player. So with CERN, as an organization, we have very limited relations with China. But Chinese scientists are part of the big experimental collaborations, which are independent from CERN, the organization. And I think that's a good thing. So you will see a lot of students that are working on the science that CERN does through the big scientific collaborations. And again, I think that's a positive thing. But there's no real structural relationship between CERN, the organization, and China.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing all these insights with us.
Thank you, Thomas. Pleasure.
Das war mein Interview mit Mark Thompson, dem Chef des Kernforschungszentrums CERN. Er wird bei den Technology Talks 2026 später diese Woche in Wien zu Gast sein. Mehr Infos dazu gibt es in den Shownotes dieser Folge. Wir hören uns schon nächste Woche wieder bei der ersten Folge der zweiten Staffel von Was wir wissen. Ciao, Papa! Das war Was wir wissen, ein Podcast des österreichischen Wissenschaftsfonds FWF. Redaktion und Produktion in redaktioneller Unabhängigkeit Francesca Grandolfo und Thomas Zauner. Technische Unterstützung Sissi Grant. Musik Kaspar Ahrens. Visuelle Gestaltung Hammer Albrecht.